This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Jace Clayton, also known as DJ Rupture, is an experimental DJ, composer, ethnomusicologist, and writer. His worldwide travels as a DJ has fueled his writing, in which he analyzes music past and present. His work has appeared in the Washington Post and the New York Times, and he's got a new book. It's called Uproot, Travels in 21st Century Music and Digital Culture. It's part memoir, part travelogue, and part analysis of the evolution of music. His new multimedia composition called Room 21 will be performed tomorrow night at the Barnes Foundation as part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Radio Times producer John Ahrens had a chance to talk with Clayton about his life, his work, and 21st century music.
Jace Clayton, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, John.
You are an experimental DJ, for lack of a better term. You play songs from all over the globe, of all different genres, of all different times. You also do play dance music. I would also describe you as a experimental composer. You're a prolific writer. You just wrote a new book. And I'm wondering, say you're at a cocktail party and someone asks you, what do you do? What answer do you give them?
Yeah, that's actually a surprisingly difficult question. I'm a musician and a writer. That's the shortest way of encapsulating what it is that I do.
And when people inevitably follow up with, what instrument do you play?
Then I laugh and I say, well, actually, I don't play any instruments. I come from DJing and electronic music, so DJing and software.
I want to go back into your past and ask you about the first thing that got you interested in making music.
Yeah, so this is a funny story, which might need to be edited for radio, but I was like 15 years old, and I'd been listening to all sorts of different sounds because I lived within striking distance of Boston area college radio stations. And at some point, through listening, I ended up ordering a cassette of Japanese noise music, and the title was Eat Shit Noise Music. And when I got it, it was just ridiculous lo-fi banging sounds, visceral concrete music. First of all, it blew my mind. You know, I was like, this is music? Like, people are making this somewhere? But then the second thought was like, wow, okay, the musical world is open. You don't need to have a piano. You don't need to know singing techniques. You can just take whatever's at hand and go at it. You too can do this. You too can participate.
And noise music, for those who don't know, it's more of a sonic experimentation focused on textures and new sounds of all different kinds rather than songs themselves, rather than beats and melodies. Would you say you're more interested in sound than song? Was this something that gripped you about this particular tape?
Yeah, it's less sound than song. It was, to me, the tape was saying, you know, there are no rules. And that was very interesting, you know, because, of course, what you get, you know, you turn the radio and you're like, oh, pop songs, they play by a fairly small set of rules. And that changes from place to place. But this tape was, to me, saying, you can do anything. You can put it on a cassette and it will reach people. And so actually maybe make less of a distinction than most people between a song and a sound. I'm very interested in both aspects of that world. So a song in the expanded sense, you could say.
How did you make the jump from being a fan of lo-fi noise from Japan to wanting to DJ?
That happened when I would go out dancing when I was younger in Boston. And around 95, 96, the DJs would start playing this music then called jungle, coming out of London. And to me, that it was so fast breakbeat musics with elements of reggae, elements of rave music, elements of hip-hop, but sped up and very kind of cut-and-paste, exuberant music. And hearing those sounds was what made me say, okay, I want to become a DJ. I want to get involved in the slipstream of this very thrilling musical production, very contemporary music that at the time was only available on, you know, import 12-inch records from the UK.
I want to play a clip of a mix you made called Gold Teeth Thief. It's from 2001, and this is sort of what brought your DJing abilities to, you know, brought it wider attention. It is not confined to a genre. Like you said, you were listening to jungle DJs. Where did this inspiration to just sort of span cultures and times come from?
You know, I've always listened, I guess, fairly widely. You know, I've always had lots of different areas of my record collection, you know, from classical music to North African sounds to, you know, avant-garde, all sorts of stuff. And so while I started DJing just as a jungle DJ, and like, I'm going to play this genre, very quickly I realized, you know, why don't I try and incorporate other aspects of my record collection into my performances? You know, I feel equally comfortable working with these different types of music, and I feel equidistant in the sense. So let's try and fold in, you know, an R&B vocal. Let's try and fold in a violin line from Turkey. Let's see if all these things can work and can make sense in the mix.
So here's the clip from Gold Teeth Thief. It's the closing segment from Jace Clayton, a.k.a. DJ Ruptures 2001 mix.
Yeah, you know, so this was, I was thinking, this is the ending moment of the mix, because a lot of sort of high-energy dance music has come before, and so let's sort of, you know, have a breather and sort of calm down. And so I start off with sort of experimental electronica from Germany, Oval. You know, they're doing these clicks and cuts. And then you'll hear this ambient sound coming in from a British musician called Muslim Gauze. And then that flows into Paul Simon's Homeless. And so what you're hearing is Ladysmith Black Mambazo, you know, really incredible South African a cappella group, as sort of produced by Paul Simon. But just a few lines about this idea of homelessness that to me was tapping into the ideas of dislocation, migration, the way people and music move around. And sometimes it's comforting and sometimes it's there's a loss there. And then I wanted to end with a triumphant acoustic upbeat moment. So I brought in a very beautiful song by Miriam Makeba, you know, one of the most important African, South African singers.
How often when you DJ out and play parties are people expecting a set of pure house music or a stream of modern hip-hop hits?
It's funny. I mean, thankfully it happens less and less these days. But one of the things about being a DJ and traveling a lot is that I do go through all these audiences, you know, and maybe with any DJ, half the time you're in a room, maybe 50% of the people don't know who you are and don't know what to expect. So there will be the people who will come up and say, hey, can't you play, you know, like the latest hit? You know, can't you just play house? But I'm also fortunate insofar as DJ culture has evolved a lot. So maybe when I started in the early 2000s, that expectation that it would just be one style of music all night long was much more prevalent. Whereas now I think audiences are a bit more open-minded and a bit more used to the idea of DJs offering a kind of polyglot musical experience.
You said DJ culture has changed a lot since you started. How else has it changed?
Well, I mean, access to different sounds. Like, so when I started, you know, I bought turntables in 96, and then it was either CDs, cassettes, or vinyl. Like, that was the only way I could access music. And so turntables to me were they were the standard interface to start mixing. Whereas just 5 years in the future, you know, and maybe you could do it with a laptop or with special CDs that are designed for DJs. And then all of a sudden in 2005, YouTube appears. So suddenly, and then streaming appears, MP3s. So I sort of live this transition from needing a physical copy of the music in order to play it back to things flying around, networked listening, online listening. So that aspect of access really kind of exploded things.
And just to give listeners a taste for how you've evolved over these years, I want to play a clip from your newest mix. It's called Book NRG Mix, and it's available on SoundCloud. Can you talk a little bit about bachata music?
Yeah, so bachata, it is Dominican dance music, but it's led by these very gorgeous, supple, high-pitched staccato guitar lines. And so that's what you're hearing here. Frank Reyes is a big star. And bachata, for example, it's all over New York. There's a huge Dominican population here. But very kind of romantic, sexy music, a lot of double entendres. And this particular song, it has a kind of a merengue aspect to it. And so merengue is the sort of more up-tempo Latin percussion you can hear. And then, you know, which works, I start mixing in kind of a 4/4 housey track. And so it's this artist Contact who's remixing another person named Mele. And they just really gels together, so it gives this great kind of propulsive energy to the bachata mix. And then I flow through some more of the sort of like up-tempo house tracks. One is Pale Blue. It gives you this nice sort of pretty vocal. And then a kind of, I guess you could call it like a neo-rave track, this group Special Request, where that brings in more of a break beat and kind of a dirtier bass line to it.
As exemplified in this mix, you are interested in music from all over the world. Was it your time traveling that got you interested in music from all over the globe, or was it your interest in music from all over the globe that got you traveling?
It was the latter. It was my interest in music that sent me traveling. And for me, things really started in high school. I got a compilation that happened to have a song of this music from Morocco called Ganawa. And I'd never heard anything like it before. That just kind of opened my mind, and I started thinking, well, what else is out there? You know, like the Japanese experimental stuff, that was one thing. But I'm like, here's this sort of traditional music that also sounds very contemporary. And it's, you know, you can hear echoes of reggae or echoes of the blues, but it's clearly its own thing. And so from that point on, I just started searching out more and more. And eventually with DJing, I got to the point where I was being invited places, and sometimes I would use those opportunities to travel further and explore more.
That's DJ Jace Clayton talking with Radio Times producer John Ahrens. Clayton is in Philadelphia for the Fringe Festival. His multimedia composition, Room 21, will debut Friday night at the Barnes Foundation. More music and conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. I'm Marty Moscowen, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. Let's get back to Radio Times producer John Ahrens' interview with experimental DJ Jace Clayton. Clayton is in for the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. He also has a new book. It's called Uproot, Travels in 21st Century Music and Digital Culture.
You take umbrage with the term world music, or you define it differently than music from all over the world. Can you explain the distinction?
Yes. Yeah, I love to talk about world music because that is literally a top-down industry term. You know, in 1987, a group of British record executives got together in London and said, hey, you know, Paul Simon's Graceland is this huge success. People want to buy this stuff, but we need a name to call it so that when they walk into a record store, they can say, I'm looking for blank type of music. You know, they almost called it hot or tropical. They had all these other names. But at the end of the day, they decided on world music, and then that went out and became this kind of industry term. And so I say it's useful, I say, insofar as, you know, it defines a marketing category. But then the joke I like to say is that, to me, world music is any music with a truly global reach. You know, so Taylor Swift, 50 Cent, Beyonce, to me, that's the true world music, U2.
as you said earlier, you're interested in Moroccan music and the music of North Africa. So you formed a band while living in Spain that was sort of in this vein. Can you talk about this band Nettle a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned, I was living in Barcelona at the time and living in Spain. And I'd listened to Moroccan music for, at that point, many years. And I'd working with samples and records. But I said, you know, Barcelona has a very active Moroccan musical community. Why don't I seek out someone within that community and just, you know, get them into the studio and see what happens? And so it began with me finding a really gifted violinist, Abdel Haq Rahal. And that was the seed of the project. And I said, okay, well, let's do something where I'm working with this violin player, and then I'm bringing in my electronics and my beats and all of that, and then I start sort of doing compositions and arrangements for this group. And so by the end of my time in Barcelona in 2006, it had grown to be four people, sometimes five. I was working with a Scottish cellist, another Moroccan. And we would talk in Spanish, which was everyone's second or third language, you know, and then we're creating, I was sort of guiding us on this musical journey and thinking of, you know, if so much of the sort of world music paradigm is ideas of fusion and that, I'm like, well, why don't I have this group called Nettle? And why don't I think about friction? Why don't I think about moments where things don't translate, you know, or moments where we're sort of equally uncomfortable as musicians? Like, let's sort of not try and erase the foreignness or smooth it over, but let's really use that as the core of the project and just see what happens.
How did they react when you said, will you play violin and I'll bring my computer?
You know, it was, there are moments of musical confusion. I'd be playing, to me, which felt like a very standard hip-hop style beat, and Abdel would be like, I don't understand how the violin should relate to this. And then he would play some sort of very complicated Moroccan rhythm that I found complicated, and I would say, wow, I don't know how to relate to that. But at the personal level, everybody was excited. And that is because while there's a strong Moroccan musical community in Spain, it's not necessarily part of the wider discussion of sort of what music is happening in Barcelona. And so for the people in Nettle, they were very excited to, you know, musicians love to collaborate, and they love to collaborate sort of outside of the categories they find themselves in. And Nettle was definitely the sort of interdisciplinary hybrid project from the start. So it was very, it was very exciting for everyone.
I want to play a clip by Nettle. It's called Radio Flower from the album El Resplandor, The Shining in Dubai. Can you set it up for us?
Sure. So it's the kind of a joking concept album. And the concept here was, imagine a remake of The Shining, but set in a luxury hotel in Dubai, an abandoned luxury hotel, and the caretaker and his family are there. And then let's make music for that space, you know, so thinking about new modern cities that are only 30 years old, thinking about different types of haunting in these spaces of capital, the spaces of desert. And so this Radio Flower, it was built around, you'll hear Abdel's violin, and then you'll hear some sort of bristling electronic improvisations around it. Thank you.
What was it about The Shining that made you want to compose around that idea?
Yeah, it's because, you know, it's the question I ask myself more and more lately, which is like, why make any music at all? You know, there's so much music in the world. Like, why do something? And so with Nettle, I had all these sketches and ideas in play. And this is a friend of mine, Jeff Minogue, an architecture writer. Somehow he made the joke of you could remake The Shining in a Dubai hotel, and that would be, you know, the 2015 version of it. And I said, what a great idea. And we sort of laughed about it, but it really stayed in my mind. And then it was such a sort of quirky and interesting scenario that I realized, I've got some songs already in my head that would totally make sense in that space. And partly as a composer at the time, I'd been doing so much beat work. I said, you know, I want to make an album where I'm not sort of basing it around percussion and beats. I want it to be primarily strings and electronics and ambience and thinking about sort of acoustic spaces. And so that also led me to think of, okay, this is the perfect reason to sort of do it all together and put it out into the world.
Your book Uproot is subtitled Travels in 21st Century Music and Digital Culture. In your view, what separates 21st century music from 20th century music?
It was the difference is this transition that we got from the late 90s to the early 2000s, going from primarily analog ways of recording music and sharing music to primarily digital. And so with that shift, all sorts of new movements and new access opens up. You know, like I like to say, you know, YouTube has only been around for 11 years, but we sort of go there now expecting to hear anything between YouTube and streaming services, whereas 15 years ago, none of this was possible. And so the music of the 21st century, to me, you know, you could call it digital native. You could call it music that has internalized all these new conditions of inexpensive laptops, of MP3s, of a kid in Azerbaijan being able to access the new single by Frank Ocean at the same time that, you know, people in New York are. Like, so that's sort of the smallness of the world and the widespread aspect of digital music making tools that defines this musical moment, music of the 21st century.
So people are able to access music from all over the world and incorporate sounds from anywhere into their own style. Do you see that creating new styles more often than maybe people like meeting in the middle and all making the same kind of thing?
You know, there's certainly both, you know, and so part of what I do as a DJ and as a writer is I'm looking for the people who are taking this widespread availability of global sounds and creating something that speaks to their very specific local conditions. You know, ultimately, I'm very interested in how music socializes in wherever it comes from, you know, like what's it like in the club? What's it like in the concert hall? What's it like in the community of musicians and however they survive, wherever they are? And so there certainly is a lot of, you know, I could say like generic techno is being made in every country of the world right now. Like that's certainly a thing. But I'm certainly attracted to the moments where people are saying, okay, I've got these new tools and I'm listening further afield than ever before. But I can take all that information and create something that speaks to my sort of immediate community of people.
In terms of MP3 culture, do you think it makes music more disposable?
Yes, MP3 culture does make music more disposable. That said, we've only been able to record music for 110 years now. So this links back to me with this greater consideration where so much music has been so disposable, quote unquote, for so long that I see MP3 culture as a way, it's almost reinstating a kind of oral culture in music and reinstating a kind of folk approach to music. Well, you hear a song, it'll pass through you, but you're not going to have it in a box set in a way, this sort of material moment. It's almost a blip in the history of music.
So you are less inclined to revisit it as much as you would if you spent $15 on an album. You'll just let it happen.
Yes.
And it'll be like the first time you hear a song, every time you hear a song.
Yes. And I should say there's tremendous anxiety. Like I make albums, I make songs. I want people to engage with them and repeat listens. There's enough information and excitement in there to stand up to repeat listens. So it's certainly, it's a mixed bag for sure, but
another thing that has emerged in the 21st century and since music has become more digitally oriented is quantization. That is when music composed on a computer is often composed to a very specific meter, a click track, as it were.
Yes.
Do you see this as fortunate, unfortunate, or just another thing that has changed the way music is and you don't feel either way about it?
Yeah, this is a quantization. That's great. Let's see, how could I say this? It's quantization. The thing is, there's always people making music who will buck against whatever the sort of limiting presets that are there. And so quantization can, yeah, it can like take the funk or take the swing out of music in a way which can, you know, almost like suck the air out of it. And yet, you know, you bring in a sampler, you bring in kids misusing the technology, there are always ways to bend it. And one thing I've noticed, which is very actually like a real, almost a real problem, is that computer software doesn't work well with polyrhythms. It doesn't work well with complex or subtle time signatures. So almost everything you hear made in a computer will be in a 4-4 beat, whereas, you know, you can get all sorts of very complicated and different time signatures in the real world. And so overall, there are certainly aspects of music making in digital environments that lessen the possibilities that you would get just with two drummers working together. They can do all these subtle things that a computer kind of freaks out about. And so I think there's, to me, the response to that is like, we need to make new and more interesting tools to sort of like make sure the human, these very nuanced aspect of human expression can exist in a digital environment.
Another thing that has emerged in addition to quantization is autotune, which you talk about in your book quite a bit. A lot of people deride autotune, saying that it's killing vocal performance and it's making untalented people sound talented. But I've also heard Quincy Jones defend it, saying it's another tool in the box, much like reverb or distortion or anything like that. You have a pretty nuanced take on it yourself. Can you explain your view of autotune?
Sure. I mean, I dedicate a chapter of the book to autotune because to me it's the most emblematic new musical tool of the 21st century. You know, it's software. It affects us at the level of the voice. So it's very intimate and very strange. And some people love it and some people hate it. You know, I agree with Quincy Jones insofar as I'm like, this is a tool. And not only is it just one aspect of a toolbox, but one of the things I do in the book is I trace out how autotune operates very differently in different places. You know, Cher was the pioneer in using it in the sort of crazy robotic way we understand today. But I go and
that
travel
was with her
to,
song Believe from what?
Exactly.
1998?
Yeah. To sort of open the floodgates. But then, you know, only 3 or 4 years later, like I stumbled across otherwise conservative wedding music from Berber, Morocco, from South Morocco, in which everything was fairly standard, like they've been doing it for 10 years, except for full synthy autotune on the vocals. And I was like, what's going on? You know, and this was before T-Pain. This was before it kind of entered into the popular imagination.
So did you get an explanation for what was going on?
It's funny. Yes, I got 10,000 words of explanation. No, I... because it is, it's complicated. And I was really thinking, like, let's try and really get to the bottom of this. And so one of the answers that I found was this style of melisma. And, you know, melisma is when you sing one syllable, but you push that syllable up and down through different pitches. This style of melisma, it's incredibly popular all across North Africa and has been for hundreds and hundreds of years. And one of the things about melisma, these vocal lines, is that it's precisely the type of singing that sort of provokes autotune into its most unusual and kind of extravagant effects. And so I'm saying, yeah, you know, people in the Maghreb are really used to appreciating vocals that are doing wonderful things with, you know, microtonal pitch control and the melismatic moments. And so when autotune comes in, that's exactly where it's happening. So that's one aspect of it. But then in the Berber-Moroccan context, it actually taps into these sort of, stereotypes. There, this idea of the sort of clarion call, piercing-voiced mountain woman, it's tied to these ideas of sort of ideal Berber womanhood. And in a strange way, autotune, when they make their voices go incredibly synthy and robotic, it almost amplifies this stereotype of the feminine. So it's incredibly complicated and incredibly, it's not one size fits all. It's not like this is a joke. It's a joke everywhere. No, it's actually doing some very, yeah, very sort of distinct cultural work in a Moroccan context.
Seems to fit right in with your fascination, which is blending traditional ideas, acoustic sounds, with the more modern digital. Would you say that that's an accurate assessment of your niche or your area of interest?
Yes. Yeah, I am. I certainly am. You know, it's like, well, like, what can we do with the current possibilities offered by, you know, cutting edge musical technology? And then what can we learn from long standing musical cultures that have evolved, you know, over the decades or centuries, as it were? So certainly.
It also seems to fit in with, at least from my perspective, like I said, autotune is often derided by purists. And in America, dance music is often derided as stupid or uninformed or for dumb people. Is that true? I mean, in your book, you said America's a bad place to be a DJ.
Yes, it is true. Yeah, people are like, oh, you know, some DJ, like, it's knucklehead music just for partying and just, blah, you know, abandon. The image isn't improving with the sort of EDM mega festivals. This idea that dance music and mindlessness are connected. That's very prevalent in American society.
And that's DJ Jace Clayton, also known as DJ Rupture, talking with Radio Times producer John Ahrens. Clayton is in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Fringe Festival for a performance tomorrow night at the Barnes Foundation. Much more conversation after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY. Jace Clayton is an experimental DJ, minimalist composer, ethnomusicologist, and a writer. His new book is called Uproot: Travels in 21st Century Music and Digital Culture. His composition, Room 21, will debut at the Barnes Foundation on Friday night. The piece uses the record collection of Dr. Albert Barnes and involves musicians from all over the world. He's talking with Radio Times producer John Ahrens.
This is something I've always been interested in. Where do you draw the line between cross-cultural exchange and appropriation?
It's actually, I think, to me, it's the difference to me between cross-cultural exchange and appropriation has to do with authority levels and kind of on both sides. You know, it's an exchange if there's an open conversation about what's happening and why and where whatever music is being produced is going. And it's an appropriation if there's minimum conversation. It's an appropriation if, you know, say it's two people, if one of those people is the person who's doing the negotiating, who's presenting it to the public and shaping it. So the more responsibility is shared among the collaborators, the more that's a cross-cultural moment that's, you know, that's the kind of thing we need to see. And the more we have, oh, I'm the producer, I hire the musician, you know, she comes into my studio, does this thing, and then she leaves, and then I package a track and say, no, that often tends towards appropriation.
I want to get back to you as composer and play a section of your composition, Dust Starch Meets, featuring rapper Saul Williams and the Mivos Quartet. It was performed earlier this year. What can you tell us about this piece?
Well, so this came out of a commission by Liquid Music and the Givens Foundation. And when they approached me, they're like, would you like to work with Saul Williams, the Mivos? And I was like, absolutely. You know, I've been a fan of Saul's work for ages. Mivos are incredible players. And so I actually asked them, can I write the libretto for Saul as well? You know, which is, and they said, sure, go to it. And so, you know, I don't pretend to write poetry. So what I did was I drew on the works of a very interesting 1970s, late 1960s New York City concrete poet named N.H. Pritchard, sort of like black Lower East Side writer doing very fascinating work. And I said, I'm going to take some extracts from a manuscript of his, which to me are very musical, and sort of arrange them and then set them to music. And so I asked Saul if he's open to that. He was. And then that's kind of, that was the genesis for this piece. And so the title comes from a line in one of the N.H. Pritchard poems.
All right, let's take a listen.
Summit zone, dressed away with the rain, flying in borrowed kind. Things in the basket beside, twisted, ruddy, before, without those, mostly on and under, plundered, nearly, though feasted, delighted, so as to be carried, glistening, 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 glistening. We need. Please read this and see if you qualify. If you do not care to take advantage of this, please pass it on to a friend. Gronon instead opens the door. A blind went away pulling.
How do you compose?
Yeah, I compose it with software. So I'm actually, you know, sitting in front of a laptop, clicking and writing. You know, I'm using software synthesizers, different types of, you know, virtual keyboards and whatnot. And that is where it happens. And when I'm composing for music, I start there in the computer, and then actually I work with a program. I sort of export the data from that sort of synthesizer program and then import it into staff notation that the musicians can read more easily and work with in that way.
Oh, so notation is involved.
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, notation is involved. It's funny. It starts. It's the electronic music making environment's the genesis, but then it flows out and ends up in staff notation. Yep.
Where does the similarity lie between composing a piece like this and being a DJ? Where is the common ground there?
I have to say, there's very little common ground. For me, DJing is so much, it's a conversation between the DJ and the crowd, the acoustics of the room, so much of it's improvised. You know, the DJ is making my own style, but using other records to sort of speak whatever it is I'm saying. Whereas with the composer hat on, all of a sudden it's back to notes on paper, you know. It's back to it's the opposite of improvisation. I'm just giving explicit directions to these people, and so for me it's I mean, there's some of the broader ideas of DJing are activated. You know, some of this ideas of like, oh, cultural mixing, you know, of trying to get an interesting dynamic, moments of surprise, and these are sort of wider musical questions. But in the short run, yes, they're very different activities.
You said you're responding to the crowd when you DJ, but what about when you make a DJ mix at home to put online?
True. Yeah. So making DJ mixes at home, it's just it's just me. It's just my own momentum. And then what I'll do is I'll record a draft version of it and then go out for a long walk. So I've put my body in motion and I just kind of feel, I'm like, is this really the moment? Is this the way that needs to flow?
Yeah, I always thought that was funny that people will make dance music usually at home alone in their room with headphones on. It's the opposite of being in a club.
Yes, yes.
There will be a performance of your piece at the Fringe Festival tomorrow. It's called Room 21. What can you tell us about this piece?
Yeah, so Room 21, it is it's happening at the atrium of the Barnes Foundation. And curator Lee Tussman, last year, he came to me with this idea. And he's like, would you be interested in coming to visit the Barnes, checking out this very, you know, sort of unique and idiosyncratic collection, artwork collection, and then thinking of a musical response to this? And so I was like, that sounds amazing. Let's do it. And so it grew out of that. And what can I say? So Room 21 is, of course, it's a room in the Barnes, which will be open for an hour before the concert. And that room, to me, it sort of made clear all of Barnes's, it's kind of wild ways of combinations and arranging. You know, he's mixing sacred and secular. He's got European, African, sort of American folk art all in the same space, and he puts his own formal arrangements into it. And so I was like, this is so, it's so quirky, but it's also so forward thinking in terms of he's really thinking of an art collection as an ensemble with a distinct personal imprint. And so many of his larger ideas about cultural mixing, you know, made me realize that he's thinking like a DJ. And so why don't I put together a composition that has this sort of Barnesian spirit of mixing, juxtaposition, surprise. And it, because it's in the atrium space, which is very, like, it's beautiful and large, I was like, okay, let's also play with the space, you know. So first off, I actually worked with, brought in a fashion designer, Rocio Salceda of Prieto, and I said, can you design custom outfits for all the musicians? And she was like, sure, let's do it. And then I said, okay, well, let's work with Philadelphia has this amazing Prometheus Orchestra, so a self-directed 15-member string orchestra. And then I approached them and I said, would you guys be interested in working on a piece? You know, some of it will be traditional string playing, but at other moments I'll ask you to hum or to clap or to sing. You know, would you be open to it? And they were open to it. And I also brought in some musicians from New York City, Emily Manzo and Benjamin Lee, on keyboard and banjo, and a really incredible Ethiopian musician, Gazachu Habtemariam, from Washington, D.C., that I've worked with before. And I said, hey, can you come up? And lastly, I was able to bring over an amazing vocalist, guitarist, producer from Amsterdam. His name is Arnold de Boer, and he's the lead singer of this band, The X. And I just love this idea of sort of like post-punk lyrical commentary, angular guitars. And then I set to creating a piece that would, you know, that would sort of give voice to all these different players and at the same time use this incredible atrium space that they have.
How often are you listening to music and thinking about who of these people can I bring in and collaborate with?
Yes. Yeah. It's almost like, and again, that's actually the sort of DJ thing too. It's like each player is like a palette or a record. You're saying, oh, like I know what sort of colors and sound this person will add to the mix. So let's try and think of a really interesting tapestry. And so, yeah, that was really what I did. So for Room 21, I was like looking at some of the records in the Barnes collection, spending time with the room itself, and that gave me an idea of the types of songs and arrangements. And then I said, who out of all these amazing musicians that I know and have had the pleasure of working with, who can I really bring together to make it all pop in this space?
You said you looked at the room itself. What is it, a feeling that you get from the room? Is there something about the architecture? What does the room itself tell you about?
Yeah, I mean, it tells me that the Barnes was a wild man. You know, on the one hand, there's a medieval painting of a crucifixion scene, so like deeply charged religious painting, and opposite of it is a Modigliani nude, you know, so there's just a butt in the air. And then right in the middle of the room, there's this big African statue that you need to walk around. And this goes on and on. He's got chairs, he's got metalworks. And so there's something about this idea of playfulness. There's something about this idea of like, what does a democratic cultural space look like? You know, where all these different types of culture, ideas of virtuosity, what happens when they're all in the same space together? And what does that proximity do just to your idea of the whole? So that was a really interesting, you know, being in one of the Barnes rooms, to me, it's very much this idea of each piece might be an individual voice, but you're always considering the ensemble. You know, there's always an artwork to the side, above it. There's always this other dialogue going on. So I've been saying that Room 21, it's very urban, you know. And when I say urban, I mean that when you're in a city, there's just you're always bumping into different people, different scenarios. There's always something more. You're never alone. And that was kind of the sensation I got.
And have you guys practiced together before? Or will you have rehearsed at all?
Yes. Yeah, we've been doing some – we have been rehearsing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great. And the way it – yeah, I should say we have been – we've had the opportunity to rehearse in the atrium space, which has been really fantastic. And then Prometheus, we've also rehearsed in other spaces in Philadelphia. So yeah.
When you approach someone from the X or these fashion designers, are they familiar with you, or do you have to do a pitch? I'm wondering.
Both.
Into DJ Ruptures, NRG.
Yes, I should say I'm fortunate because people are, yes, they're familiar with me. And then, and especially in a project like this, it's large scale, it's ambitious, right. And it's taking them a few steps outside of their comfort zones, you know, so I sit them down and say, okay, this is what I'm going to ask you to do. This is where we're going with it. So there's definitely a pitch and a contextualization to make it all make sense. But I've been lucky. So.
It seems like you're actually really into taking people out of their comfort zones.
Yeah. You know, and that's has to do with like creating something new, creating something surprising. And I wouldn't want to go into writing a new piece of music if it was just reproducing the same thing I've always done. And so I try and surprise myself, but then I also try and surprise the players and the musicians I ask to collaborate with me.
And another thing I think about is in America, we have this idea that rock music is like the real music, but rock doesn't really get too much of a mention in your book. In your view, is rock music dead?
I could say it's dead to me.
Yeah,
it's funny. I just don't really listen to so much rock music, so much guitar-based American music. It's just kind of not on the recipe. And partly because I'm interested in the interaction between sort of electronic music, but then also it's somehow, it's just less exciting for me as a listener, you know? So what can I say? It certainly goes forward, you know, it's going to go forward on and on.
It does?
But in a way, yes, it's a ground that's so covered and it's never kind of, sparks my curiosity in a way that the stuff I'm writing about does. So,
well, Jace Clayton, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
That was producer John Aaron speaking with Jace Clayton, also known as DJ Rupture, about his music and his new book, Uproot. Clayton's Composition 21 will debut tomorrow night at the Barnes Foundation. This is part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, John Aarons, Liz Fiedler, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Tell us what you think of the show. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're closing things out with the first few moments of DJ Rupture's 2008 mix called Uproot, featuring songs by Baby Kites, Nokia, and Elders.